Okay, I think we start. Welcome everybody, welcome Adam. It's a very great pleasure to have you here. Our speaker tonight is Adam Branch. He's a university lecturer at the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity Hall. He did his PhD in political science at Columbia University and did also BA at Harvard University. Prior to joining Cambridge, he was a senior research fellow at the Makerere Institute of Social Research in Kampala in Uganda and an associate professor of political science at San Diego State University in the US. Besides his numerous articles, he also published two books, one in 2015 with the title Africa Uprising, Popular Protests and Political Change, Zed Books, and in 2011 with Oxford University Press, Displacing Human Rights, War and Intervention in Northern Uganda. He's also spent extensive time working with human rights organizations in Uganda and also elsewhere globally. His talk tonight builds on his current research on the trial against Dominic Ongwen and the ICC, which we are also doing research on, so we're very excited to have you here tonight. The title of your talk is The Trial of Dominic Ongwen, Rupturing Narratives of Responsibility. Thank you very much for being with us here.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the very kind invitation to bring me here. It's great, as you said, to be giving a talk about something that people here are working on as well, so it's wonderful. Now, the talk is on something rather specific, so it's about the trial of Dominic Ongwen, which I'll talk about in front of the International Criminal Court. I realize that some of the issues I'm going to bring up might be somewhat particular to the case or might be perhaps of less interest to people who aren't specialists in Northern Uganda or in the ICC or in international trials. That said, you can ignore those parts, and then in the question and answer, we can bring up any question that people would like to pose about ICC in Africa, the LRA, whatever. So I welcome the question and answer at the end as an opportunity to raise much bigger questions. So anything you want to bring up during that would be great by me. So that said, just over 2 years ago now, in fact, in January 2015, Dominic Ongwen, who was the former commander in the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, appeared for the very first time in front of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. He was flanked by two very solicitous police officers. He was dressed in a dark blue suit, headphones on, computer monitors surrounding him. He looked a bit dazed as he faced this battery of lawyers and judges and the functionaries of international law. But of course, his discomfort shouldn't be surprising considering what he had just been through over the last 2 weeks. 2 weeks previously, 6th of January, 2015, in a remote area of Central African Republic, or CAR, Dominic Ongwen had surrendered to Seleka rebels. The Seleka rebels didn't know his identity, but they delivered him to United States Special Forces, who were located in the area, to provide training to an African Union regional task force, which was fighting the LRA. With Ongwen in the hands of U.S. Special Forces and his identity then established, it appears that the U.S. then gave Ongwen to the Ugandan contingent of the African Union Task Force, who flew him to Bangui, the capital of CAR. Through the intermediacy of CAR, Ongwen was then transferred to ICC custody and then from there flown to The Hague, where he's been held ever since. Now, a year ago, in late January 2016, Ongwen's confirmation of charges hearing was held to determine whether there was sufficient evidence to go forward with a trial. In March of last year, judges confirmed almost all the charges, and the trial began in December of last year. And it's going on today. What did it happen today?
It's continuing on
the 28th. The 28th, okay, right. So today, no, but it'll go, and it could go on for the next 2 years or 3 years. We don't know. So you might have heard of Joseph Kony, who's the leader of the LRA. He's still at large. The other three commanders who the ICC had issued arrest warrants against are probably dead. So the trial of Dominic Ongwen might be the only
trial in what had been the ICC's sort of landmark first case when it started over 10 years ago. So when Ung Wen was captured, we can get a sense of the kind of excitement over the possibilities that this heralded for the ICC from Fatou Bensouda, who's the chief prosecutor. Fatou Bensouda said, quote, "I welcome the news that Dominic Ung Wen has surrendered and been transferred to the custody of the ICC. I'm grateful for the persistent efforts of the government of Uganda, the government of Central African Republic, the Uganda People's Defense Force, the African Union Regional Task Force, and generally all who have helped realize this significant achievement. Ung Wen's transfer to the ICC sends an unequivocal message that no matter how long it takes, the ICC will not stop until the perpetrators of the most serious international crimes are prosecuted." Now, in this statement and a number of other statements that were heard during that time, we hear a very compelling narrative of the triumph of international criminal law. Bensouda presents Ung Wen's arrest as an exemplar of international law enforcement carried out by the international community as kind of proof of the ICC's increasing efficacy. She gives us a narrative in which regional cooperation by states dedicated to ending impunity has brought justice to victims. And so she draws a firm line between those whose violence is designated as enforcing international law and thus morally and legally legitimate, and on the other hand, those whose violence is condemned as criminal atrocity and thus are legitimate targets of humanitarian force. But Bensouda's narrative, of course, hid a more uncomfortable reality. For one thing, Seleka, the group to which Ung Wen surrendered that handed him over, Seleka is itself subject to ICC investigation for many of the same crimes that the LRA stands accused of. And when Bensouda opened the case involving Seleka, she declared, "The atrocities are endless." And so perhaps it's not a surprise that Seleka ended up erased from Bensouda's statement, given that attention to their role in the capture of Ung Wen in the enforcement of international law would rupture the narrative of a clean division between international law enforcement and criminal violence. Also erased from her statement was the role that U.S. Special Forces played. There's an expanding U.S. military presence in Africa under the African Command, AFRICOM, and that, of course, has provoked intense criticism from African human rights activists, also from African states, at least in public. And so my feeling is that her concern with being seen as sort of celebrating U.S. Special Forces as champions of international law may have kept them from appearing in her statement as well. But even the presence of Ugandan troops in Central African Republic, which she does mention, is not unambivalent. Uganda is a sort of regional security broker and often a U.S. proxy. But it too has been accused of looting and of atrocities in the regions that they occupy of Central African Republic, the very region where they're there supposedly to protect the population from the LRA. For Uganda, of course, involvement in an African Union mission committed to capturing the LRA offered it the opportunity to secure international legitimacy and international assistance for its military presence in the region. But of course, all this is hidden. And Bensouda's statement effectively erases Seleka and the U.S. Special Forces, and then implicitly condones Ugandan military expansion as a humanitarian instrument of international law enforcement. Now, Ung Wen's transfer to the ICC also was not the simple case of the international community upholding international criminal law implied by Bensouda. It's still a bit unclear as to what exactly happened in that jungle in Central African Republic 2 years ago, but it looks like the U.S. actually had to force Uganda to transfer Ung Wen to The Hague for trial. Why is the U.S., which is not a party to it, getting Uganda to transfer him when Uganda is the state party and actually asked the ICC to prosecute Ung Wen? I think it ties into U.S. strategy towards the ICC, which is a kind of strategic engagement. U.S. policy has been to support the ICC when the ICC supports U.S. interests, in exchange for which the ICC avoids any prosecutions that might be against U.S. interests. And this was really started by Bush, but then perfected by Obama. And so it was a contingent alignment of self-interested violence and regional militarization that led to Aung Wen's handover to the ICC, upon which the prosecutors sought to build a narrative that retrospectively sanctified that violence as an instance, as a paradigm or a paragon of international law enforcement. And to do this, the prosecution had to draw a clean distinction between humanitarian violence on the one side and criminal atrocity on the other, draw this clean distinction on a field of very complex political violence. But of course, given the prevalence of violence and often of atrocity by all sides in the kind of situation like the LRA war, the ICC had to erase this problematic politics or even the atrocity that was part of the supposed enforcement of international criminal law. And of course, somewhat to the embarrassment of the ICC, these lines were quickly blurred when Seleka demanded the $5 million bounty that had been put on Aung Wen's head for his capture. And the U.S. faced the question of whether they should pay a group that's that alleged war criminals for capturing another alleged war criminal. I don't think they did, but we don't know. Now, in Aung Wen's case, all of these sort of awkward questions could largely be left behind by spiriting him off to The Hague. This narrative of the triumph of international law enforcement by the international community cemented as the conventional wisdom. And especially once in The Hague, the spectacle of Aung Wen's presence in the courtroom, surrounded by this austere architecture of international law, helped erase the very complicated context from which he had been recently extracted. But what we've seen is that new questions have arisen around the narratives that the ICC prosecution is trying to construct in the courtroom. For Aung Wen's arrest certainly wasn't the last time that the prosecution sought to impose a clear narrative of responsibility upon Dominic Aung Wen, upon the war of which he was a part, or upon the actors who were involved in these 20 years of devastation in northern Uganda. So what I want to go through in this talk are three other sort of key prosecution narratives. One, that Aung Wen is an autonomous moral agent who can be held criminally responsible. Two, that the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, had a clear political agenda, but that agenda had no resonance among the civilian population. And three, that the Ugandan government was categorically innocent without any responsibility for anti-civilian violence or the protraction of the war. So what I want to do is go through each of those and show why the prosecution had to adhere to each of those, but at the same time, why each of those narratives was threatened with rupture by counter-narratives that invoked the kind of recalcitrant facts and ambiguities of situations of long-standing political violence. And so what I want to conclude with is the strong possibility that any kind of justice may be unattainable through Aung Wen's trial. But before looking at the Aung Wen trial itself, I first want to step back a bit and look at some of the sort of bigger questions that are involved, the larger context. Because I think that Aung Wen's trial does not signal the possible failure of the ICC only in this particular case. But rather, I think Aung Wen's trial helps illuminate some of the dilemmas that undermine the ICC as a mode of transitional justice in Africa more generally. Now, my view is that, now you wouldn't be surprised that coming from a political scientist and not an anthropologist, but my view is that the kind of lack of fit between the ICC and Africa isn't a result of cultural difference. What some identify as a kind of divergence between African concepts of perhaps restorative justice and the ICC's Western mode of justice. But in my view, the ICC's often counterproductive role in Africa, the lack of fit between the ICC and the reality of conflicts in Africa, is rather a product of the political history of ICC intervention into the continent over the last 15 years, in particular, a product of the strategy that the prosecution has used in carrying out its prosecutions. And so I think that the Ong Wen trial can help provide insight into the difficulty of this court playing a positive role in justice, peace, or even any political transition in Africa, which of course is somewhat ironic because the ICC has in practice become the kind of de facto transitional justice mechanism for the continent. Both because of the ICC's exclusive focus on Africa and its significant impact. And so what I want to do briefly for now is to sort of contextualize the Ong Wen trial within this political history of the ICC's engagement with Africa as a way of laying the groundwork for elucidating some broader lessons of this trial. Now, as people here probably know, every formal ICC investigation to date but one has been in Africa. And to date, the ICC has prosecuted only Africans. Now, the prosecutor and many ICC supporters attribute the court's Africa focus to legal rationales. For example, that it's following referrals, that it's pursuing the gravest atrocities, intervening where national judicial systems are the weakest. Or else to moral criteria. Kofi Annan announced, Africa wants this court, Africa needs this court. But in my view, more convincing are the political considerations behind the ICC's Africa focus. So the ICC was conceived in the 1990s, during the age of humanitarian intervention. But it was born in 2002, in the age of the war on terror. And so the ICC faced vehement opposition from the US when it was first founded. And so the ICC prosecution, thinking itself under grave threat before it had even started its first case, decided that the best strategy would be to conform to U.S. interests if it were to survive at all. And so the prosecution strategy was simple under the direction of Luis Moreno Campo. It made clear that it would target supposedly meaningless African violence, in particular the supposedly non-political violence of African warlords, and not the violence of the U.S. or its allies. And so the first really defining investigation for the ICC was not into the invasions of Iraq or Afghanistan, which of course were raging at this time, 2003, 2004, but rather into the Democratic Republic of the Congo, followed soon after by Uganda, Darfur, and CAR. And so I think what we saw in the early 2000s is that Africa, and in particular Central Africa, became the sole remaining object of a 1990s imaginary of humanitarian intervention. Central Africa became the only place where the ICC could still pretend that violence had no politics, and self-evident victims simply needed rescuing by the so-called international community. Now, of course, doing so is much easier in the case of Africa, given Africa's long history of being represented as a terrain of humanity, of incorrigible savages committing atrocities against victims in need of a Western savior, as Makau Matua put it. And this humanitarian image of Africa fits squarely with the prosecution's black and white, unquestionable moral narratives of inhuman criminal atrocity against innocent victims. The ICC needs pure victims and pure perpetrators without ambiguities or gray areas, and in Africa could claim to have found both. Now, Africa was also chosen because it was the only place politically marginal enough that the ICC figured that the US would allow the court to intervene there, and also politically weak enough so that those subject to intervention would be unlikely to challenge the ICC or hold it accountable. And so Africa ended up playing a key role in the establishment of the court, as intervention into Africa in the name of rescuing humanity from atrocity allowed the court to legitimate itself and avoid US censure post 9/11. But just avoiding Western opposition, in a sense, wasn't enough, because the ICC also had to find some kind of enforcement capacity if it was going to be effective. And so the history of the ICC in Africa has been a history of the court's efforts to align itself with Western support in a bid for assistance in capturing subjects or suspects. Equally important have been the close relationships that the prosecution has cultivated with African states that are willing to facilitate investigations and arrests. And in practice, the ICC has typically managed to secure this cooperation of African and Western states by tacitly offering them de facto immunity from prosecution in exchange. And so we've seen the court siding with the military force of the US in Libya, Uganda, Darfur, that of France and Cote d'Ivoire and Mali. Uganda may be the paradigmatic case of alignment with a powerful African state, but almost everywhere, the ICC has pursued viable prosecutions by pragmatically siding with the stronger party or victor to conflicts, which often means those supported by the West. Where it hasn't done so, such as in Kenya, it's led to humiliation for the court. And not surprisingly, for their part, once African states realized that the ICC was willing to offer them immunity in exchange for cooperation, states have taken advantage of the court, instrumentalizing it to their own political agendas by seeking to use it to criminalize opposition and drape their own violence in the mantle of law enforcement. Now, the problem for the prosecution, as we saw in the capture of Ong Wen, the problem for the ICC is that in many of the situations, if not all the situations, all of the actors with which the ICC has allied itself and offered de facto immunity have themselves been accused of criminal violence. Whether it's Uganda, whether it's NATO bombing in Libya, whether it's French intervention and Ouattara's forces in Cote d'Ivoire. And so the result is that the ICC cannot help but end up conducting politically selective prosecutions, trying only some parties when violence by all sides could possibly fall under its jurisdiction. And so the result is that the ICC not only views African conflicts through its stark categories of victim-perpetrator, but ends up imposing that framework onto the situations into which it intervenes, with often highly dangerous consequences. And so where the ICC imposes this moralized framework upon the often long-standing, deeply socially embedded forms of violence that can characterize African conflicts, in which the lines between victim and perpetrator may not be very clear to begin with, these conflicts can end up being endowed with a polarizing logic of friend-enemy, potentially intensifying violence and raising the stakes in the service of those who benefit from prolonged conflict. So ICC intervention can end up entrenching the violence and impunity of the powerful, render transitions harder to achieve, and even silence democratic and pro-peace forces. And so the sort of structural problem faced by the ICC is that it's systematically prone to constructing moral narratives about conflict in Africa and then seeking to impose those narratives through the medium of supporting states or armed groups that wish to use those narratives to support their own violence. And of course, the ICC's ability to impose those narratives with its partners is facilitated by the fact that the court can dismiss criticism by invoking Africa's image as a terrain of helpless victims or ignoring African voices in a way that would simply be impossible in other regions. ICC trials end up looking like victor's justice or vengeance, increasing animosity instead of enabling reconciliation, as the court undermines its legitimacy on the continent through its efforts to prove its efficacy. And so the problems of ICC interventions in Africa are the product of much more than a simple lack of fit between legal categories and a messy social reality, a disjuncture that characterizes all criminal trials to some extent. But the ICC's lack of fit stems from the politics of its involvement, which has led the disjunctures or dilemmas found in other international criminal trials to take on a systematically extreme and dangerous form in the ICC's Africa interventions. And so the consequence is that ICC interventions in Africa will be subject to intense challenge by voices both inside and outside the courtroom in the name of justice, truth, and peace, opening prosecution narratives to the constant threat of rupture. Which puts the ICC in a difficult situation, of course, because without Africa especially Africa as it has been violently constructed by the West over 200 years. Without Africa, there can be no global justice by an international criminal court on the model of the ICC. Kofi Annan may have said that Africa needs the court, but instead, I think it's actually the ICC that needs Africa. And so the Uganda case has put the dilemmas of the ICC's engagement with Africa on full display. Or the Uganda situation. When the ICC first intervened in Uganda at the height of the war, back in 2004, the court deployed a specific narrative, and that sort of reflected long-standing images of the war. Uganda, of course, was a Western favorite, even at that time, for its embrace of neoliberal structural adjustment and its enthusiastic participation in the war on terror. And so the Ugandan government was portrayed internationally. If you've seen Kony 2012, you've seen this on the screen. The Ugandan government was portrayed as waging a desperate counterinsurgency against the LRA in a well-intentioned but shorthanded effort to protect civilians. As to the LRA, media reports told of an army of abducted children led by a self-proclaimed spirit medium, using violence against their own people for no apparent reason. The only motivation they could find was that the rebels wanted to govern Uganda in accordance with the Christian Ten Commandments, which has proved their insanity and irrationality. So the ICC bought into this narrative when it intervened. Luis Moreno Campo denounced the LRA as a criminal organization. As the story went that the Ugandan government just needed assistance, whether from the ICC or from US AFRICOM, the Ugandan government needed international assistance in its just war against the terrorist LRA. And so the government's counterinsurgency was cast as unambiguously humanitarian. When the ICC intervened, Uganda effectively became a partner in the investigation against the LRA, not a possible suspect in the ICC's investigation. And so it was no surprise to anyone that when arrest warrants were issued in 2005, only five LRA commanders were named. And to this date, they are still the only ones who have had arrest warrants issued for them in ICC's involvement. Now, the prosecution seems to have thought that it was going to be welcomed with open arms in northern Uganda. Luis Moreno Campo reassured Acholi victims, Acholi being the dominant ethnic group in the north. Luis Moreno Campo reassured Acholi victims, quote, "I am doing justice for you." And during that time, hyperbolic statements of a rapid return to peace were often heard from the court and its boosters. But to the apparent shock of the court, its intervention was met with deep opposition from many of the very peace and human rights activists who it thought would be its champions in northern Uganda. Now, the grounds for this opposition were several. There were fears that the arrest warrants were going to undermine peace talks, which were fragile in the best of times. There was fear that the arrest warrants were going to undo the hard-won amnesty that had been gained by civil society and peace activists. The arrest warrants were going to be used by the government to demand a military solution because you can't negotiate with war criminals. And of course, there were the accusations that the ICC was taking the Ugandan government's side, which it clearly was, or that its punitive justice was inapplicable to Acholi traditions of justice. The ICC responded with a familiar mix of co-opting, denouncing, and simply ignoring its critics. Then a few years later, with the LRA's departure from northern Uganda in 2007, 2008, the final breakdown of peace talks, the rebels dispersed into Central Africa. And at that point, what had been very heated disputes within Uganda over the ICC dissipated as well. As a sense, the task of rebuilding the region after 20 years of intense devastation took precedence over the very improbable trials of four faraway individuals. But with Aung Nguyen's appearance in front of the ICC, some of these debates have been reignited again. And so I think we see a new interest in the ICC and in the Uganda case at present because of this case. Now, I think today's most prominent controversy centers around a very inconvenient fact for the prosecution, one that Aung Nguyen himself drew attention to in his very first statement at his pretrial hearing in 2015. When asked about his date of birth, Nguyen responded that he had been born in 1975 and then continued, "I was abducted in 1988 and taken to the bush when I was 14 years old." However, it turned out that Nguyen may have been mistaken about his age and may have only been 9 years old at the time of his abduction by the LRA. So this image of Dominic Nguyen as a victim of the brutality of the LRA, as well as a perpetrator of that brutality, and the consequent conundrum of attributing criminal responsibility to a man who grew up in the rebels' ranks, this has provided kind of the most prominent story about the trial internationally. And it's also provided a significant part of the defense team's argument against Nguyen's prosecution. So Nguyen's defense team has sought to undermine the claim that Nguyen could even be held criminally responsible. And in doing so, they've kind of tacked between two narratives. On the one hand, Nguyen's defense team has argued that Nguyen's early abduction, what they call spiritual indoctrination, prevented him from integrating into normal society. He never reached mental maturity. He, quote, remained a child up to the time he surrendered in his late 30s, blindly following LRA Commander Joseph Kony's orders to kill. So that's on the one side, the indoctrination argument. On the other side, the defense mobilized a duress argument, implying that even if Nguyen had possessed a capacity for moral reasoning, he remained with the LRA and committed atrocities because he knew that otherwise he, his family, and the inhabitants of his village would be killed by the LRA as revenge. So the ICC prosecution, for its part, it was under no illusions about the very serious disruptive power of this victim-perpetrator narrative. And so it attacked it head-on to try to prevent it from sweeping the ground out from not only the trial, the prosecution of Nguyen, but the prosecution of anyone who could be cast as a victim-perpetrator. And so, in order to dismantle both the indoctrination and duress argument, and establish the possibility of Nguyen's criminal responsibility, the prosecution had to construct a narrative of his utter monstrosity and absolute acquiescence to his crimes. So to counter the indoctrination defense, the ICC prosecutor, Benjamin Gumpert, who's a London barrister, Gumpert first agreed that Nguyen had indeed once been a victim, but his sympathy didn't last long. And he immediately turned to describe Nguyen's most horrific violence, including accusations of cannibalism. And Gumpert said, "This phenomenon of the perpetrator-victim is not restricted to international courts. It's familiar in all criminal jurisdictions. Drug dealers rarely boast serene, untroubled childhoods. But there's no reason to expect that crimes can be committed with impunity. Each human being must be taken to be endowed with moral responsibility for their actions. If we choose to rape and enslave, we must expect to be held to account." And so the prosecution has argued that Nguyen was an adult well past the age of 18 when he committed the crimes, and in the absence of medical evidence that Nguyen possessed normal mental faculties, we must assume that he was a rational individual who knew he was doing wrong. Otherwise, no criminal trial could proceed, says Gumpert. Second, to counter the duress defense, the prosecution invoked Nguyen's supposed enthusiasm for killing. They argued that Nguyen climbed the ranks of the LRA under his own initiative, helped by his reputation for brutality. He failed to escape the LRA despite many chances to do so, used violence far beyond the minimum that he would have had to in order to survive. And they described intercepted radio communications in which Nguyen is heard speaking after an atrocity. Prosecution says, quote, "Nguyen laughs during those communications. That is not the state of mind of somebody under duress. It's the state of mind of somebody who's enjoying and proud of what he is doing." So Nguyen's laughter becomes proof of his free choice to commit and enjoy atrocities, and thus of his capacity for criminal responsibility. Even if he didn't consent to his initial recruitment, the prosecution says, his laughter condemns him by demonstrating that he did later consent to the system that he became a part of. And so to nullify any relevance of Nguyen's initial abduction, To deal with this very ambiguous reality, the prosecution has to portray Aung Wen in stark black and white terms, a cannibalistic monster who laughed over his atrocities. Now, despite their very different judgments as to Aung Wen's criminal responsibility, I think it's important to note that both the defense and prosecution, both narratives rely on the same image of what is a normal human based upon a particular conception of reason and consent. They simply disagree on how that model should be applied to Aung Wen. Now, this normal human either consents completely or does not consent completely. For the defense, the trauma of Aung Wen's initial abduction and the continued threat of force place him in the category of absolutely not consenting and thus not criminally responsible. For the prosecution, Aung Wen's adult age at the time he performed his actions and his supposed enjoyment of grotesque violence render him absolutely consenting and thus criminally responsible. But of course, this model of the normal human required by the ICC doesn't fit with reality. In situations like the war in Uganda, in which long-standing violence has been deeply incorporated into societies, which people must live under and try to make meaningful lives within global and local structures of violent constraint, consent is never absolute, and agency is always entangled and qualified. So a belief in mind reading or the rightness of a cause is not something that's permanently on or off, and Aung Wen, it seems, believed uncertainly in Kon's spiritual authority and mind-reading powers. He had been indoctrinated and was under duress, but he also had access to other moral worlds and came to his own decisions. He laughed and he tried to flee. And so I think this question of individual criminal liability, which is potentially problematic in any criminal trial, becomes so extreme in some of the ICC's Africa interventions as to throw the very foundation of law into doubt. Now, the prosecution's need to impose stark, untenable narratives goes further than Aung Wen himself. As I mentioned, when the ICC first intervened in northern Uganda in the mid-2000s, it seemed to buy into this dominant narrative of the LRA, irrational, barbaric violence. Today, however, the prosecution's portrayal of the ICC has reversed. At his confirmation of charges hearing, the prosecution had insisted that the LRA, in fact, always had a clear political agenda, a firm organization and hierarchy. No mention is made of the Ten Commandments, because the prosecution needs to be able to establish Aung Wen in a position of command responsibility in which he gives orders within a hierarchy that are obeyed so that ultimate responsibility can be attributed to Aung Wen. War crimes require real war and not just irrational violence. Crimes against humanity need to be part of a widespread or systematic attack. And so today, in an effort to absolve Aung Wen of responsibility for crimes against humanity, it's instead the defense that argues that the LRA had no agenda. It was entirely under the control of Joseph Kon, and that it had no real organization or chain of command. And so the defense had to insist that the LRA lacked a political agenda, either because of indoctrination, which basically rendered the entire LRA sort of spiritual slaves, as it was put in one time, of Joseph Kon, in thrall to Joseph Kon, or else that they were under such duress that there was no political agenda, that the entire LRA was just obeying out of fear. Now, these two arguments are somewhat in tension, but they both imply that the LRA lacked any political agenda. If LRA members were indoctrinated to believe in Joseph Kon's authority, his belief in a spiritual agenda, not a political agenda, or if they were held together by fear, there was no belief in any agenda. Either way, the defense's narratives exclude the possibility that the LRA had an agenda that some members adhered to because it resonated with their experiences, reflections, or beliefs. Now, this mischaracterization misrepresents reality. A number of scholars, mostly anthropologists, who have been working in northern Uganda since the late 90s, have shown that the LRA did articulate a political agenda which many of its members believed in, whether through manifestos or statements, whether through sometimes even by calling in to the radio station. Many of the LRA members who have left or been captured have explained a deep adherence to, a deep belief in the political agenda of the LRA. And of course, these political beliefs were always present together with a complex belief in Joseph Kony's spiritual authority and the fear of consequences of defecting. So, although the prosecution gave credence to the LRA's possession of a political agenda because they needed to establish Ngwen's criminal responsibility, they ran into contradictions resulting from their simultaneous need to deny that agenda any legitimacy among civilians and frame the LRA's relationship with the population as one of pure violence. So the defense's argument implies the impossibility that LRA members could have been motivated by a considered adherence to a political agenda, whereas the prosecution has to insist on the narrative giving the LRA a political agenda while refusing that that agenda had any resonance amongst the civilian population. This also was undone by the facts. And to understand why the prosecution needed to unconditionally deny that the LRA agenda had any support among civilians, we need to look at the third prosecution narrative, which is the innocence of the Ugandan government. Now, although the Ugandan government's narrative of the LRA has been reversed, its narrative concerning the Ugandan government has remained constant. The prosecution has gone out of its way to establish the government's innocence without the defense even raising government crimes as an issue. And as we might suspect, there are powerful pressures from both inside and outside the trial for the prosecution to insist on the government's innocence. The Office of the Prosecutor has aligned itself with the Ugandan government for political and practical reasons. And the prosecution has thus had to find ways to deal with those voices who were calling attention to government crimes or demanding that the ICC prosecute Ugandan government officials, doing so by invoking the vague idea of gravity or complementarity, letting the Ugandan government prosecute itself. So if new evidence of government crimes were to arise during Ngwen's trial, it would threaten to delegitimate the prosecution's selective approach and its alignment with the Ugandan government. Now, inside the trial, the prosecution's evidence has depended very heavily upon Ugandan government cooperation. In fact, information provided by the Ugandan government to the prosecution is indispensable to the trial. Early in the investigation, Ugandan military officials would accompany ICC investigators and prosecutors. And it turns out that a large bulk of the ICC prosecution's evidence is gathered from captured radio communications that the Ugandan government and military have given over to the prosecution as evidence. Now, it's also probable that many of the prosecution's witnesses who are former LRA members are today under the control or threat of the Ugandan military. And so if this narrative of a responsible Ugandan government waging a good faith struggle to protect civilians against the terrorist LRA, if that were shaken during the trial by the revelation of evidence of Ugandan government crimes, all of a sudden a large part of the prosecution's evidence would come into doubt because that evidence has been provided by the Ugandan government. Now, the problem for the prosecution, of course, is that a wide range of research has shown that the Ugandan government was not the good faith protector of civilians that the prosecution needs it to be. The history of the war is long and complex, but the government was certainly not categorically innocent of crimes against the civilian population. And so to maintain this narrative of government innocence, the prosecution has had to silence the brutality of the government's counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency, which included the forced displacement of the entire rural population of northern Uganda, over 1 million people, into internment camps. This forced displacement and internment killed far more people than the direct violence of the war did. Now, of course, the prosecution has to silence this history. And to insist on a narrative of government blamelessness is also to ignore those arguments that the Ugandan government was not, in fact, committed to ending the war. Many have argued that the government was happy to let a contained war on terror continue and perhaps even brought in the ICC in order to entrench and prolong that war, not to bring it to an end. And the fact that victims are going to be called to testify, especially defense victims, raises the possibility that they could present some of these inconvenient facts about government culpability, thus threatening to rupture the legitimacy of the prosecution's reliance upon government cooperation and information and its policy of not prosecuting the government. And so the government, the prosecution's need for government innocence helps clarify why it needs to insist on the illegitimacy of the LRA's political agenda. If the prosecution were to admit that the LRA's political agenda had resonance with civilians, that would suggest that the LRA's anti-government agenda had its origin in government violence and repression against the civilian population. This, in turn, would undo the strict division between an evil LRA and a good Ugandan government. It would undermine the evidentiary basis of the ICC's case against Aung Nguyen and call into question the prosecution's alignment with the Ugandan government, probably scuttling the case. But of course, to insist on this narrative, the prosecution has to ignore all of this evidence of Ugandan government crimes. And it also has to ignore the evidence that mostly anthropologists have been bringing out of significant civilian support, perhaps not of the LRA itself, but rather of the political agenda that the LRA was putting forth. And so the prosecution is in a position where it needs to grant the LRA a political agenda, which its members are said to believe in and carry out, at the same time that it rejects the possibility that that agenda has any resonance among the Acholi population, which of course begs the question of where this agenda came from, a question to which the prosecution has no answer, because to answer that would be to show that the LRA's agenda arose largely from the experiences, grievances, and demands of the civilian population. And so there was no, in the same way that the defense's narrative of an absolute rejection and the lack of resonance of any political agenda among the LRA members themselves, right? Just as the defense has to argue that the LRA members had no political agenda and were either motivated by spiritual brainwashing or by terror, which is untenable. So the prosecution has to insist that the LRA had a political agenda, but that agenda had no resonance among the civilian population more broadly, which is equally untenable. And so what we're going to see, I think, going forward with the trial is how the government seeks to silence these facts as inconvenient facts about government violence arise. Any one of those facts could have such sort of resonance throughout the entire prosecution strategy, both in the courtroom and outside, that it's going to have to do what it can to silence them. And what its strategy is going to be to do that, I think, is going to be one of the very interesting things to look at going forward. So to conclude, to sort of step back and look at some of the bigger questions that are raised, there's a member of parliament, Ugandan member of parliament, Regan Okumu, who himself comes from the north. So when Aung Nguyen was arrested, he gave voice to a common sentiment when he declared Aung Nguyen's arrest to be, quote, a blessing in disguise. He said, the old debate is what shapes the future. The trial continues to be relevant. Since the government has not yet addressed the issue of northern Uganda, nothing in terms of facts has been provided to people of the north. So Okumu's hope was that, as I've been saying, perhaps the Aung Nguyen trial could open new possibilities of justice, despite the ICC's myopic focus on prosecuting only the LRA. And so some have seen The trial is an opportunity to bring to light this legacy of state atrocity, to challenge this narrative of government blamelessness and the blamelessness of the international community that has underpinned 30 years of counterproductive international involvement in Uganda. And of course, Ongwen's own abduction raises the question of how he and tens of thousands of others were abducted so easily despite the government's supposedly humanitarian military campaign. Ongwen's own abduction questions why the government did not provide adequate protection to the internment camps, why civilian militias were organized in them and then left to be slaughtered, why the LRA was able to survive for decades through regular looting and recruitment, and why mass internment without military necessity or protection was not a grave violation of the laws of war subject to ICC jurisdiction. The longevity of the LRA raises the question of how the Ugandan government created and sustained the material and political conditions for the LRA, conditions in which many young Acholi men felt that fighting with the rebels was their least bad option. And in doing so, some hope the circle of legal accountability could be expanded to include the government or even Western donors and aid agencies that provided years of essential support to the Ugandan government counterinsurgency. These counter-narratives could reveal once again the ICC's tendency to partner with powerful and violent states, whether African or Western, and to provide immunity to them in return for cooperation. But who might effectively raise these counter-narratives simply isn't clear. Even though raising them would threaten the prosecution's face, I think, or the prosecution's case, it may be difficult for the defense to do so, given the defense's own reliance upon a narrative that presents the LRA as a group that has been forced or indoctrinated into violence by the spiritual terror of Joseph Kony. And so the defense's narrative, instead of trying to rupture this portrait put forth by the prosecution, lends credibility to the prosecution's representation of the Ugandan government as waging a justified struggle against terrorism. And in the confirmation of charges hearing, the defense has simply didn't challenge the reliability of the prosecution's evidence that had been gathered through government-provided witnesses or government radio transmissions, where, you know, challenging that evidentiary base would be a fundamental part of challenging the prosecution's case. Now, individual victims may raise episodes of state violence, but there seems that there's little opportunity for these to cohere in any way into oppositional narratives. It may simply be lost in the courtroom. And I think it's equally difficult for effective counter-narratives put forth outside the courtroom to have much impact. Domestically, political repression continues to mount in contemporary Uganda, leaving little space for oppositional narratives to emerge around the trial. And at the same time, energies are focused on struggling against authoritarian rule rather than revisiting the Northern War and its legacies now 10 years later. Internationally, there's little desire to reopen the history of violence during the LRA war because such an accounting would basically implicate everyone who is involved. Now, a more radical option could be what has been called a trial of rupture strategy, in which, in Koskinyemi's words, the defense is conducted entirely as an attack on the system represented by the prosecution case. Ongwen's trial would be used to contest the prosecution's narrative and to put forth another narrative, one that doesn't necessarily absolve Ongwen on the terms presented by the prosecution, but places his alleged violence in the context of violence by those putting on and benefiting from the trial: the Ugandan government, its Western supporters, even the ICC itself. Taken furthest, a rupture strategy would lead to tactics of refusal, silence, disruption, even open confrontation within the courtroom, evoking perhaps episodes in the past when camp inhabitants would throw rocks at ICC vehicles in a rejection of the court's complicity with the Ugandan government and military. And something else that would result, the supposed necessity of ICC involvement to redeem victims and punish perpetrators would also be unsettled. But as I've said, there's little sign that defense would pursue such a radical approach, focused as they are, for obvious reasons, on securing Ongwen's acquittal. But in my view, an acquittal would represent little more than the preemption of another politicized sacrifice to an illusory global criminal justice. A conviction would bring some satisfaction to those among Aung Nguyen's victims who wish to see him punished, but would not amount to law enforcement or the rule of law. It would simply amount to little more than an ad hoc act of vengeance purchased at a very steep price. So in my view, at this point, there seems to be little chance that any kind of substantive justice can emerge from the spectacle of Aung Nguyen's trial. But what may prove even more important for the future of transitional justice in Africa is the fact that the very moment that the trial is beginning is the same moment that the ICC's first triumphalist phase in Africa may be coming to an end. Today, the assumption that led the ICC to focus on Africa in the first place, the idea that it could intervene in the continent without being challenged, this itself is being ruptured as African states, most importantly South Africa, are moving to withdraw from the court. And so the image of Africa as a terrain of suffering humanity in need of rescue is being forcefully rejected by a number of African states today. So whatever the outcome of the Aung Nguyen trial and its consequences for the fate of the ICC, my feeling is that its significance will probably be dwarfed by these large-scale political shifts. And so the trial may simply be the last act in the ICC's precipitous rise and fall. And the court may need to find an entirely new approach to international criminal law to give a radically new meaning to its practice of global justice if it's going to survive either with or without Africa. Thank you.